Welcome again to the Milt Rosenberg Podcast, and it is not a matter of total accident that it's Milt Rosenberg speaking, and speaking, in fact, to the author of a most important new book. Richard Easton is the co-author, the senior author, one might say, of GPS Declassified. I think almost everybody listening to us, Richard, must be able to decode GPS. It stands for?
Global Positioning System.
Global Positioning System. And maybe I wouldn't be here today in this studio, but for the Global Positioning System, because I have on the dashboard of my car one of those magical instrumentations. How it works, I don't know, but I will learn during the next 40 or 50 minutes. It tells me just where to make every turn to get to my destination. In fact, we are in the studio at WGN Radio in Chicago, and I've been here rather frequently before. But if I wanted to go, say, to your house, and you live in the suburbs of Chicago, I could enter the address, and if I wanted to turn on the sound, I could also get verbal instructions, turn here, turn there, and so on, till I'm at your doorstep. That is made possible by GPS.
That's correct. GPS is a system of a minimum of 24 satellites launched by the U.S. Air Force in 12-hour orbits, so they're about 12,500 miles above the Earth, and they can give you your three-dimensional position anywhere on the Earth where you can get the signal from the satellites.
And they can do this not just for me or maybe a few other people. They can do it for millions of people and institutions at the very same moment.
Correct. It's similar to radio. I mean, it's a radio signal. So in theory, an unlimited number of people can receive WGN's signal.
True.
And it's a passive system, which means that the receiver does not emit any signal, which is very important for a military system. So an unlimited number of people can get the GPS signal, can find out what their position is, and then with a mapping program like in your car, it can tell you what's the optimal way to get to my address.
In introducing you, I did not say what your profession was. In fact, you are not a space scientist, so I think on the basis of your own personal interest in this matter, you virtually become one in terms of all of your knowledge. But in fact, you're an actuary working for a major insurance firm at a high level in their operation. But there's a special connection between you and GPS.
Yes. My father, Roger Easton, who recently passed, played a major role in its formulation and development.
Indeed, major role is a polite way to put it. There's been some competition as to who really deserves the ultimate credit as the initiator, the man without whom, sine qua non, it might not have happened on the same schedule. And in general, the consensus in the technological world now is it's Roger Easton.
That's correct. If you look at our website, we have some of the major documents. Our website is gpsdeclassified.com. Under resources, we have some of the primary source materials. My dad started a program called Timation for Time Navigation. And if you look at the Timation Development Plan from 1971 and you look at GPS, they are very close.
I have one thing in common with your father when it comes to research. We were both supported by the Navy. My first research contract when I was a kid assistant professor at Yale was with the Office of Naval Research. I was not doing space science. I was doing social psychology. But the Navy was always a great research operation, actually.
The Naval Research Lab, where my dad worked from 1943 until he retired in 1980, is part of the Office of Naval Research.
Yeah.
So you were getting your funding from the same bucket in the government.
But I was getting a much smaller piece from the bucket. It's pretty expensive to do the sort of thing that your father and his colleagues did.
Yes, and they were involved in space from the very early. The second U.S. satellite put in orbit, the Vanguard 1, was developed by the Naval Research Lab. And in 1955, the International Geophysical Year, which was actually a year and a half, like all good government programs, It was from July 57 through December 58. In 1955, both the U.S. and the Soviets announced that they would launch a satellite during the International Geophysical Year. The U.S. set up a committee, Stewart Committee, to decide who would get the nod, and three proposals were evaluated. The two major ones were the Navy with an upgraded Viking, which they called theirs Project Vanguard, and Wernher von Braun and the Army with what ultimately became the Explorer. The Navy got the nod, partially because they had better space tracking. The Naval Research Lab was very good at miniaturizing electronics. They got the nod. Of course, the Soviets surprised us with their launch in October of 57 of Sputnik 1, and then a month later, Sputnik 2 with a dog, you know, Laika. And then we had the disaster in December 57 of TV3 from the Navy exploding on the pad, and the Army ultimately launched the first U.S. satellite. But one of the major things, the sources for GPS is space tracking. Three of the people who came up with space-based navigation systems tracked Sputnik, and they realized they could reverse the problem. We're using ground stations to track satellite. Well, can't we use satellites to track a receiver? And the first space-based navigation system, Transit, came from people at the Applied Physics Labs of Johns Hopkins. Roy Anderson with General Electric also came up with a system. And my father, with the Naval Research Lab, with his mini-track tracking system that was a from Blossom Point, Maryland to Santiago, Chile. That was used to track Sputnik, and ultimately that was the source of his timation system, where he realized he could reverse the problem and use satellites with very precise atomic clocks on them to give you the distance from the satellite to the receiver. And with three of those, you can get your three-dimensional position. If you had a synchronized clock, use the fourth satellite to synchronize the clock. That's how timation worked. That's how GPS works.
And how does it work when the magical voice coming to me in my car says, next turn onto Michigan Avenue and go down as far as Ohio, turn left on Ohio, et cetera, et cetera?
GPS is used to tell you where you are on the map. You have a mapping system in your GPS receiver, which has the grid in Chicago, Illinois, and the whole U.S.
And it does it have the grid for just about every place in the world?
Depends how. They probably, if it's a receiver that's primarily used in the U.S., they probably would not. You're not going to take a car abroad. On the other hand, if you have a smartphone, it's Google Maps is worldwide, so that could tell you where you are anywhere on the earth. And of course, these maps.
Even if you're down at Tierra del Fuego at the bottom of South America.
That is correct.
Looking into the Straits of Magellan. If I take out my smartphone, I can do what?
You can tell, it'll tell you where you are. Uh-huh. And if you have a program for automobile or hiking program, you know, it could tell you what's the optimal path to get to where you're heading to. And of course, these receivers, they have different levels of sophistication. Some heavily used by truckers will tell you, will adjust it based on the traffic at that time. So Magellan or Trimble or smartphones, they would be using receivers from the same system to tell you how fast they're moving, and they might tell you, oh, the tri-state is jammed up, so you should go on side roads to get to this destination. Or they would be updated for construction. You know, the left two lanes are blocked, so you should be in the far right lane. Or even they could tell you, you know, two layer level bridges which one you should be on.
Your father, Roger Easton, had, of course, many patents and, as I say, is generally credited consensually by people in the technological world as being the prime mover in the long story of the development of GPS. One of the very important things that he introduced was the atomic clock, or rather, many atomic clocks. What does that mean, and why are they necessary?
An atomic clock, it's preferred atomic frequency standard. It's using characteristics of different atoms to calculate time very precisely. In 1967, we have switched from using the Earth to measure time. In 67, they switched to the cesium atom and how quickly it would vibrate to tell you time intervals. And atomic clocks are very stable, and the first atomic clock in orbit was my dad's Timation 3 satellite in 1974, which used a rubidium atomic clock, and then the cesium atomic clock in 1977 in Timation 4. And today, GPS uses hydrogen masers in the ground station and either rubidiums or cesium atomic clocks in the satellite to get time precisely measured. And the radio wave is going at the speed of light. So if it takes, speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. If it took a tenth of a second to go from the satellite to you, you know you're 18,600 miles from the satellite.
You're talking to me as if I were sophisticated in these matters, as if I were at least a graduate student in space science or something of the sort. If you were called in to address a first-grade class, how would you explain just what GPS is and what it does to those children?
Let's say you're driving in a car that is going 60 miles per hour, and you know where the car started off. You're a minute later, so 60 miles per hour in 1 minute, the car is going to drive a mile. So you would know you're on a sphere of a circle 1 mile from your starting point. So if you had another car that started from another position and they collided, you would know that you were on the surface of a sphere around the first clock car, a mile away from it. And let's say the other car started a minute and a half later. You would know the second car started in a different position, has gone a mile and a half when they collided. So from that, you could estimate where you are if you knew the beginning positions. So basically, that's how GPS is working, except it's much faster.
I would think a fairly bright six-year-old might understand that. And I have the illusion of comprehension after reading this fine book of yours, GPS Declassified, subtitle From Smart Bombs to Smartphones. And this is by Richard D. Easton, our guest today, and co-author Eric Fraser. A foreword by Rick Sturdivant. Who is he? Very enthusiastic for the book he's introducing.
Rick Sturdivant is a historian who's worked at Air Force Space Command, where they control GPS since, I think, the late 80s, and he's an expert on GPS.
Now, let's come to the fact that he works for the Air Force. Your father worked for Naval Research for all of those years. And let's come to the fact, indeed, it's given in your subtitle, From Smart Bombs to Smartphones, we come to the fact that this began as a military program. Computer space or the Internet began as a military program. What was the original military challenge? How did we go from military to the vast array now, this panoply of civilian applications of GPS?
The first space-based navigation system, Transit, was started in the late 50s, and it became operational in the mid-60s. It could give two-dimensional positions a couple periodically throughout the day. So it was very good.
You can locate objects by longitude and latitude.
Correct. It was good for Polaris missile subs trying to update their inertial navigation system for where they are. But it was not adequate for an airplane. You needed a much more sophisticated system to give airplanes their position. And in particular, in the late 60s, you had the Vietnam War and the military's difficulty in knocking down various North Korean bridges. And so the Navy and the Air Force in particular had their competing
systems.
Did
you mean North Korean bridges or North Vietnamese bridges?
North Vietnamese.
Right.
Yes. There were various navigation systems out there, but they could not give the precision needed. And in 1973, the U.S. military set up the Joint Program Office, headed by the Air Force, to unify the different systems.
And I love the quote you've got in here. Some of the Air Force people poo-pooed the fact that the Navy was also asked to work on it, arguing, well, the Navy is only working in two dimensions, just on the surface of the water. They rather forgot that there are warships known as naval air carriers.
Yes, aircraft carriers, and also fleet defense from missiles is very important.
Now, there is a third dimension in naval warfare.
Yes, yes. And the Navy for centuries has been interested in time. Davis Sobel's excellent book, Longitude, she talks about the longitude problem in the 18th century, that there were two major solutions. One was John Harrison with the H1, 2, 3, and 4 clocks that he developed. The H4 clock became the marine chronometer. The other major solution was astronomical, taking observations of either the moons of Jupiter or of the moon. They call it lunars.
Am I right that the first military use of GPS is really in the first Persian Gulf War?
They used it to a limited extent before that in Panama, but the first major use was in Kuwait in the first Gulf War.
And going after the Iraqi army, which had gone down there.
Correct. At that point, GPS was not fully operational. It had, I think, 18 satellites in orbit, so it cannot give you nonstop your three-dimensional position. They configured the satellites to optimize their position over Iraq at various times of the day. And they were very important in particular for some of the precision attacks.
Would your father have been involved in the actual organization of that array of satellites to serve that purpose in the first Persian Gulf War?
No. He'd retired from the Naval Research Lab in 1980. He did do consulting for the Pentagon from 93 to 2000 on some improvements to GPS. The U.S. was worried about terrorists using GPS, so they put on selective availability to degrade the civilian signal.
I guess they would still be worried about that, wouldn't they?
Yes, but by now there are other systems out there. But like all good government systems, the Department of Defense was putting selective availability to degrade the civilian signal, while other government entities were coming up with differential GPS to offset that.
What other applications of GPS to military purposes and intentions has developed over the years?
One is precision timing. The first Gulf War, when the helicopters were going in to knock out Saddam Hussein's radar in western Iraq, they were using GPS to time their attacks. They wanted to make sure they knocked out these two radars at the same time. Tracking of where your units are. For a commander, knowing where all of his units are and knowing where resupply is very important.
How about tracking the enemy? One thing that we've done in recent years, done a great deal of, is tracking Al-Qaeda personnel, supposedly properly identified, someplace or other around the Middle East, and ultimately sending smart bombs or drone-carried killer weapons. And we supposedly kill a lot of people that way. It's sort of been a cheaper way of waging the anti-Al-Qaeda war that has been favored by the current president.
Yes, the drones would be using GPS and inertial navigation to tell them where they are, and their smart bomb would be targeted by GPS. At the same time, they'd be using a mapping program to tell them the position of the target.
We all watched today later when they gave us the video record of it, the killing of Osama bin Laden, the attack upon his Abbottabad location, and the SEAL team that went in and did the work. To what degree would GPS have been involved there?
GPS would have been very much involved. The attack helicopters would have used it. They would have known the coordinates, similar to your car, you know, where you're driving to an address. They would have known from satellite mapping exactly where the compound was. And by the same token, their route there, they were routed a direction to make sure they were not detected by the Pakistanis on the way in. So GPS would have been an integral part of that attack.
And the military, our military and other military, will go on finding new applications for GPS. But when does – what's the crucial event that shifts from military to other uses?
Well, some people say the shoot-down of the Korean Airline Flight 7 in 1983 was important.
That was over Soviet territory.
Yes, yes. There are many theories, but it appears that their inertial navigation system did not fully lock in, and as a result, they drifted further and further off course. I think that's exaggerated. GPS was envisioned as both military and civilian from the very beginning. And the previous navigation system, Transit, you know, it became operational in the mid-60s, and it was quickly developed for use by civilians on boats. Yachtsmen would use Transit. So civilians...
To find out where they were on the water?
Yes. And one of the earliest civilian uses of GPS was by surveyors. So even if you only have a couple of GPS satellites up, like InSight, as was the case in the mid-1980s, you know, if you're a surveyor and you just leave your instrument, it will see the satellites as they come by. You're surveying a fixed location. So GPS was quickly used in the 1980s for surveying. And simply thing, utilities were using GPS to help them detect where all their telephone poles were. Even in the mid to late 80s, that was started to be used.
When Amazon or some other such corporation from whom I've purchased something via the Internet offers me the opportunity to find out where the purchased item is at the moment, is that based in any way upon GPS?
Yes. They would be, you know, whatever service, UPS, FedEx, they would have GPS on their trucks or on the individual book or, you know, tracking it as it went from the warehouse to your location.
Here's a challenge for you. Think of the last 2 or 3 days in your own real life. Let's see. We are recording this on a Friday, so you've been at work, I guess, every one of those days. Go back to last weekend and think your way through from last Saturday to this moment in time. How has GPS aided you? What has GPS done for you personally, you and your wife, in your normal course of daily and nightly activity?
Directed us to a restaurant that I go to once every couple weeks, but is not, you know, it involves a fair number of turns. So I can just punch that into my, actually what I do is to locations recently visited in my car, I just punch that in and it gives me turn-by-turn directions.
If you go there every couple of weeks, you're a pretty smart fella. You should have learned it by now without depending upon the machine.
Well, that's one of the, you know, one of the challenges of GPS, that one of the things we deal with in the book is, you know, similar to books.
Yeah.
You know, prior to books, you have Homer, you have people who could recite thousands of lines of material. with books, that ability atrophied. On the other hand, you had access to a lot more material than the people reciting homework could have possibly had.
Okay, so you were guided to the restaurant. What else?
Yes. I'd say that was my major use of GPS.
In the whole last week?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm taking the train into work, and I know the location, so I'm not using GPS. Oh, one other thing. I have a GPS watch, and I like to jog, so that will tell me how far I ran and what my average pace was per mile. So I have a GPS-aided watch.
You have a smartphone as well, do you not?
Yes, yes.
What have you done on the smartphone that you could not have done but for the existence of GPS?
Probably the only thing which I haven't done in the last week. You know, sometimes I like to amuse myself on the train by using one of the mapping programs I've got there just to see what's going on with traffic patterns near the train, you know, whether it's a rush hour, the ones in red means that there's heavy traffic. So I can see traffic patterns. But for the past week going into work, I haven't done anything extraordinary. A couple weeks ago when I was visiting New York, we were using GPS a fair bit to go to restaurants that we weren't familiar with or go to a play. You know, I punched in the address of the theater, and we were just walking to it. So that was useful.
Your father, who, as I noted, died only a few weeks ago, and at full of the richness of years, he was in his 90s, was he not?
Yes.
So he saw all of this developing from the beginning. Was he surprised by the later turns that the technology took?
He was surprised by the range of civilian applications that, you know, just the explosion of uses of GPS. I mean, I said the Joint Program Office was founded in 1973, and GPS had many twists and turns. It was almost canceled several times in the late 70s and early 80s, and it was saved by putting nuclear detection devices on the satellites. So it was not clear at all in 1973 to 1983 that GPS would even survive the bureaucracy. But the range of civilian applications, I mean, farmers using GPS to maximize their use of fertilizer, the widespread tracking, you know, again, commercial fleets tracking all their trucks, Amazon using it to tell you your position. I mean, the internet in 1973 was under development, but certainly the widespread civilian use of the Amazon of the internet was not conceived of. On the other hand, people like Arthur C. Clarke in 1956 in a letter, he envisioned the use of a GPS-type system, which he thought would arise within the following 30 years, which would give you your position on your wristwatch. So there were people who saw that space satellites could be used for navigation and would revolutionize it.
You might say that Borges, the great Argentinian writer, in a way also envisioned the internet, not GPS, in that his concept of a universal library, which goes on forever, and coding systems which enable you to dig anything out that you need instantly.
In a 1974 interview in Science, I believe it was in Science magazine, my dad said GPS will lead to a worldwide web of synchronized time.
Hmm.
So, and that was before the internet, you know, the concept of World Wide Web. Just synchronizing your time is very important for fiber optic networks to maximize the use of them. Like I said, the first Gulf War, when the U.S. helicopters were going to knock out Saddam's radar, you know, they used GPS to make sure that their attack was carefully synchronized.
You were talking, as you well know, to a social psychologist rather than a technology expert. But from the point of view of the social disciplines, a question that always arises is how does significant new technology alter the daily lives of ordinary people, for that matter, even the construction of their identities, or one might, in shorthand, simply say their personalities, and how does new technology ultimately affect the organization and the functioning of total societies? In fact, what is the role of new technology in historic change? All of that comes to mind as a set of pressing questions when you look at something like GPS, just as it does when you look at the Internet, just as it did for many who grappled for years with the question of what did the introduction of the internal combustion engine and the Ford car or other early cars, what did that do to alter people and alter the world in which they lived?
Oh, for that matter, the trains. You know, you have the train developed in England starting, I think, in the first 1827, and soon you have the middle class taking tours. Charlotte Bronte could get to London much faster, and you know, the train broke down some of the aristocratic, you know, the grand tour. Mm-hmm. Now you suddenly could travel much faster. GPS, I know that kids today are using the software packages that can tell them where their friends are, you know, so you could do your mapping and, you know, where we used to have to coordinate carefully getting together. Of course, this leads to privacy issues, too.
And the death of privacy.
Yes, yes.
Which concerns some people a great deal.
Well, and the joke is if you're a criminal, don't bring your smartphone, because the authorities will be able to tell that, geez, you said you were in San Diego, where you were actually in San Francisco, where this person was murdered.
Or something that happened just the other day. A guy came up to a bank counter and said, give me your money. And the person did, the person behind the teller's window, gave him money and he ran away. But somebody also slipped a tracking device in, and he was located by GPS and arrested within the hour.
Yes, or we start the story with the book with a story of a carjacking, which had the car had OnStar. So the person whose car had been stolen contacted the police, who contacted OnStar. And when the police were in position behind the stolen car, they transmitted the signal to turn off the accelerator. So the car stopped. It was the middle of the night, fortunately, so there weren't, you know, if it was rush hour on the tri-state, you might want to wait until they're getting off the highway. But the authorities were able to apprehend the thieves within 15 minutes. You know, just as we were saying, does GPS adversely affect your sense of spatial knowledge? You know, similar to the transition from the bard able to quote thousands of lines of Homer to you're having a book, it has the potential for people to lose their common sense.
Yeah. Well, you know, from the point of view of educators, particularly veterans who've been in, say, college teaching for 30, 40, or 50 years, as I had, one becomes aware of the fact that there's a change in the literacy levels of one's students. In fact, literacy is either diminished or transformed into something else. The fact is they don't read books. The fact is what they need by way of information, or what they need if they want to learn something about a classic author, they get off the screen and you get pieces of things and you put them together, and maybe that helps you write term papers. In fact, the provision of sites that give you the structure of a term paper or can personally write the thing for you, all of that is part of the picture. But the fact is, our students are not so much illiterate as post-literate, and that's a consequence of technology.
Or they, like you said, they have lots of factoids.
Yeah.
They picked off the Internet. They may lack the overall comprehension to understand the forces behind it.
Is that a worry? Should that be a worry from the point of view of educators? Should that be a worry from the point of view of parents? If your kids are replete with factoids, but no way to organize them, and no ability to put logic and common sense to work to go from that organization of separate facts to some useful generalization or some useful projection.
It's a problem. Of course, you can also use GPS to allow you to explore things, where you turn your GPS off and you try to navigate to a certain hotel. Well, you have almost a life preserver, where if you get totally lost, you can turn it back on. Whereas, you know, one of the great voyages, Ernest Shackleton, going from Elephant Island to South Georgia, he's in a tiny, I think it's 27-foot boat with six people total. His navigator, Frank Woolsey, they're making it. You know, they're sailing through the furious 50s. But his navigator is using celestial navigation. So he's trying to take sightings on the sun on this 27-foot boat. He said to Shackleton, I can't be sure of our position within 10 miles. So the moment they sighted South Georgia, even though they were on the wrong side of the island from the civilized area, they headed straight for land. Today, with GPS, he probably would have had satellite communications. So a rescue boat could have come to him on Elephant Island. But in theory, you could use things like GPS to explore and use it as a backup rather than your primary means, you know, if you're driving around, and use it to help you explore. But I'm afraid too many people use it as a crutch, and as a result, their spatial knowledge will atrophy.
We're sitting here in a radio studio in May of 2014. project forward. 50 years forward might be good. 100 years might be even better. With the kind of constantly expanding technologies that we've been talking about today, what will happen to the way we live? What will happen to the states who supposedly organize our existence, or at least organize and control the institutions through which we do the business of life? How different is technology going to make us? This kind of technology, as it burgeons on and takes yet new, almost unpredictable from this moment, turns.
Well, you have to start out, what are the problems with GPS? Jamming is a problem. At various times, like Newark Airport, they were having problems, and they found out the truckers were using jamming devices so that, you know, I talked about how GPS can be used to keep track of all the trucks. Some of the truckers don't like that, so they might use jamming devices to subvert that. Or, more seriously, if the U.S. is heavily dependent on GPS, our adversaries will use jamming devices like was hypothesized with a drone over Iran a couple years ago. Another potential problem with
What do these jamming devices do? Do they knock out or the satellites upon which the system depends?
They basically overwhelm the radar, the radio waves. So they will put out strong radio waves near the frequency of GPS so that you cannot detect the signal. I mean, in World War II, various people, the Luftwaffe was using guided missiles to attack the Allied fleets off Italy in 1943. Well, they quickly developed countermeasures to jam it so that basically they could not use radio waves to guide the bombs attacking the Allied fleets. In the same way, how could they can jam local areas to make it so you could not use GPS, or they could spoof. They tried a James Bond film from the mid-1990s had in the start, the Chinese were spoofing it so that a British ship thought that it was in a different position from where it actually was. And spoofing is also a problem. a bad solar storm. The solar storm we had in 1859, the so-called Carrington event, that could knock GPS out. So the question is, how do we make ourselves less dependent on GPS? DARPA, Advanced Research Arm of the U.S. government, they're trying to develop improved inertial navigation systems so that you'd have a good backup that could not be jammed or spoofed. But 50 years from now, if we're still using GPS, it will have much stronger signals that will be more resistant to spoofing or jamming.
Does your own thought ever run to the question of what's coming next, apart from GPS? The internet, the automobile came.
Yes.
The internet came. A lot came in between those two. GPS came. What are other potential possibilities for radical invention which would be transformative in its in the purposes it makes available and in its consequences?
I don't know if you have to be an Arthur C. Clarke to foresee
I'm
those.
Calling for a sort of science
yes,
fiction projection.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, Elon Musk, you know, with his cheaper reusable rockets to get to launch, he wants to go to Mars. And he's decided that one of the major problems with getting sufficient mass into orbit to send humans to Mars is the fact that our rockets are only used once. So he's working on reusable rockets. I would say human engineering, you know, just better ways of treating diseases where if your genetics are misfiring, you know, they can physically change the cells.
Uh-huh.
I would say that's one of the major possible enhancements of what we have today.
Let's commemorate your father just a bit. Of course, you were doing this book before his death, but his death was anticipated, and that may have motivated you to do the book in full detail. It's in wonderful detail. You and your co-author, Eric Frazier, obviously have full mastery of the technology, but also have the literary skills to convey the history of this great new technology. But at the center of that history is Roger Easton. Tell us something about him.
He grew up in Craftsbury Common, Vermont, northeastern Vermont. Craftsbury Common is best known as where Alfred Hitchcock filmed his movie The Trouble with Harry. And Trouble with Harry is a murder mystery, except contrary to normal murder mysteries, everyone thinks they killed Harry. And it turns out at the end he died of natural causes. So they have the comedic aspect of that. Graduated from Middlebury College in 1942, a semester early, and studied at University of Michigan for a semester, which is where he met my mom. He started working at the Naval Research Lab in 43. In 52, he transferred to work on the Viking sounding rockets, which were used for upper atmospheric research. They set the record at the time, I think 156 miles for a one-stage rocket.
I must interrupt you with a crucial question. You haven't mentioned a PhD.
No, he did not have a PhD.
He did not have a doctoral degree?
No, no.
So where did he get this tremendous expertise and this tremendous inventive capability?
One of his colleagues, Marty Voltasso, told me he, at times he couldn't find my dad. And he learned that when he couldn't find my dad, to go to the Naval Research Lab library, the dad was researching something new. And the dad said he knew very little about electronics when he joined the lab. But over time, you know, the pressure of needing to solve problems led him to enhance his knowledge. And, you know, you wonder whether the structured program of a PhD might inhibit some of the, you know, first off, it takes time. And, you know, for the great inventors, it's like Steve Jobs dropping out of Apple. I mean, I mean, dropping out of Harvard to found, mm-hmm. co-found Apple. You know, for the really ingenious people, do they want to go their own path? And, you know, is a PhD really needed for something like that? But like I said, he was involved in putting the first satellite in orbit, the Vanguard 1, which carried solar cells. So the solar cells could power a transmitter. Vanguard 1 powered it for 6 years, I'm sorry, whereas previous transmitters like Sputnik only lasted a couple weeks. So, you know, improving the technology. From Minitrack, they had the problem, how are we going to track Soviet spy satellites? Well, he developed a much more powerful system called the Naval Space Surveillance System that could track spy satellites that were not emitting a signal. And then on space surveillance, he had the problem of synchronizing the clocks in the different transmitters. And you could try to transmit time over the horizon, but that was noisy. Or you could drive a clock from one to the other, but the clock would drift. And he said, well, geez, I can put the clocks in a satellite and synchronize the space surveillance clocks. And, oh, gosh, with atomic clocks, he was having a conversation in April of 64 with Dr. Arnold Shostak of the Office of Naval Research about atomic clocks, particularly the hydrogen maser, which had been developed in 1960. Geez, that makes range measurement, which is how GPS feasible. So, you know, one problem solution led to another problem, which you could use some of the concepts you'd previously used to solve that. And really, the idea of, you know, the Earth revolves around in 24 hours, and just as John Harrison said, I can use a very accurate clock to synchronize to get my longitude. Well, GPS combines those two solutions. You know, in the 18th century, they had either astronomical objects like the moon taking measurements of that or using precise clocks. And GPS, you put the precise clocks in an artificial astronomical object, a satellite.
One of the keys to creativity is that you combine things that others somehow fail to understand are combinable. And that's... In a way, what he's doing there.
Yes, he developed two different space tracking systems, Minitrack and then space surveillance.
Yeah.
And thinking about problems there led him to say, geez, let's put the atomic clocks in the satellites. And to do that, you know, in 1964, atomic clocks were heavy. They used a lot of power. So you had to envision where will they be at some point in the future. And of course... You know, just as the space program helped lead to improved computers, the drive to develop things like GPS led talented individuals like Bob Kern to develop smaller and smaller atomic clocks that could be used in a satellite.
Indulge the psychologist who's talking to you with a response to this simple human question. What kind of a father was he?
He was a good father. He was not interested in forcing you into his mold, but he really he was interested in people. And, of course, for things like GPS, how do you use human psychology? How do you get the Navy to adopt this, where the Navy is a very traditional service? Well, you start out with things they know, like celestial navigation, and you explain how satellite-based navigation works on a similar concept, or how you can think of it in terms of celestial navigation, which they already understood. And they call that celestial transformation. They developed that in 1965, and that helped get support for Timation. So, you know, one of the problems we all have, and I have, is when I'm arguing or talking with somebody, I'm thinking of what arguments will convince me, as opposing opposed to what arguments will convince the person I'm talking with. And I think he had a good ability to understand, okay, for a Navy officer who learned how to use a sextant and how to take observations of the sky to tell him his longitude and latitude, how do I explain that you can use something similar with radio waves from a satellite revolving 12,000 miles overhead? That type of how do you do it?
We have just about run out of the available time. I want to make very clear to all who have listened that we've been drawing from an excellent and important new book, GPS Declassified, From Smart Bombs to Smartphones, by Richard Easton and Eric Frazier. And that is published by Potomac Books. And we might close with this comment about the book from Walter Boyne, who was in his time director of the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian. He says, quote, "The authors do the impossible, making an intricate technological advance fascinating to read. They offer an informative and well-researched account of how GPS proved its worth even before the system was complete. The results it provided in the Persian Gulf War were truly revolutionary. With the seemingly miraculous kickoff, GPS technology was almost immediately integrated throughout military systems. Entrepreneurs immediately picked up on this and made it equally successful in commerce." And you have been quite successful, you and your co-author, in making all of this clear to the reading public. I thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.